310 to Yuma, right?
Good morning. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. It's Friday, the 10th of April. What we're going to do is we've got a couple of different bills for public hearing, continuations, carryover, and also work sessions. What I want to do is to open up one public hearing so we can get Senator Devlin's testimony, and then I'm going to go back to what we were carried over from yesterday, because I told those individuals they would be up first, but I, in deference to Senator Devlin, I need to do that. But before I do that, I do want to acknowledge a person that's sitting at the dais today, so those who are wondering who this person is, it's Melanie Gibson. She is a third-year student, junior at Oregon State University. She's shadowing me today, and so I want to welcome her. I hope she has a good experience today learning about the Oregon legislature and what we do here on judiciary. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 928.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 928 requires employers to make reasonable safety accommodations for victims of domestic violence, prohibits employer from refusing to hire or retaliating against a domestic violence victim because they are a victim, allows employer to request documentation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and thank you for allowing me to testify in support of SB 928. Senate Bill 928 protects employees who are victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking from discrimination or retaliation in the workplace. The bill asks for an employer to make reasonable safety accommodations if requested by the employee who is a victim of domestic violence. The bill does not specify what reasonable accommodations are, but it could include, if possible, such things as changing work schedule, changing work telephone number, or moving the victim's desk to another location, if possible. The state already has a similar policy. In 2007, the governor issued an executive order on domestic violence in the workplace. The executive order prohibits discrimination for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking, and goes on to list other requirements like posting of policies and referral services. Senate Bill 928 does not go as far as the policies that have been implemented by the state. I would ask, and my testimony is going to be very short here today, that you do everything possible, and I think this bill is a good step in the right direction to make sure all victims of domestic violence feel safe while at work.
All right, thank you, Senator Devlin. Is there any questions for Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Devlin, just because I don't see it in here, is the intent to ensure or to fully implement workplace rules in this? Where does this fall?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Boquist, I think that question would probably be better answered by one of the parties that will testify later in this meeting today.
Thank you, sir. It seemed like Brad Avakian's a trustworthy fellow, and that would be the place it would be going, so.
I think all the statewide officials are trustworthy.
Senator, I won't take any time, but I have issue with one right now, so.
Okay.
Any other questions? But I do support the bill, so.
Thank you very much for taking time to be with us this morning. I'm going to go ahead and recess the Senate Bill 928, and I'm going to go ahead and open up a carryover on Senate Bill 256 for a continuation of the public hearing. And Bruce Miller, I'm going to ask you to come forward. Paul Snyder, and Paul, you said you had another gentleman with you. All right, please, both y'all come forward. And Bruce, if I can get you to move one side just so they can be together, that'd be nice. And then, Brad, I see that you're back, and you'll be on after this. And, Bruce, why don't you get us going?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the Office of the State Court Administrator. Thank you for taking the time to consider the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 256. These completely replace the bill, and I'd like to go through and give you a little description on that. I've given your staff copies of my written testimony that contains summaries of each of the proposals in the amendments, as well as a a one-pager that has a very brief description of each one of the proposals. It goes without saying that we all know you and your colleagues are faced with a tremendous task. You have a family of 12 to feed, and it may very well turn out that you're only going to be able to feed, have enough food for 8 or 9 of them. These amendments won't necessarily put more food on the table, but they will give the Judicial Department some flexibility in how we manage our diet. And I'd also like to point out that we do have, we are working on a package of revenue proposals that we hope to have introduced on the House side, and that may actually add to the food source for you to distribute. Our goals with these amendments are, three, we would like to gain administrative flexibility to deal with the budget reductions that we're sure we're going to face. We would like to adjust expectations on what we can reasonably be expected to provide under these conditions. And we'd like to highlight some of the significant hidden costs that do not go to the core of our functions, but that we bear for other entities in order to stimulate an open conversation on that. To my eye, the amendments fall into four broad categories: flexibility, cost shifts, fees, and juror per diem. It's a long amendment, and the chair suggested that I start with the most significant and controversial areas. So I'd like to direct you to Section 28 of the amendments, which discusses shifting grand juror costs to the counties and in some sense to the district attorneys. This is a silent cost to the Judicial Department. We pay for the grand jurors for this prosecutorial function where we have no control over the cost, the use, or the efficiency of the grand juries. It's a cost that we can't cut in our budget reductions, so it would come out of our core staffing and services. Our mandated payments are slated for cuts of several million dollars, and this would save us about $1.1 million in those mandated payments. To give you some context, that's the equivalent of about 2 months of trials with jurors and interpreters statewide. There are, of course, side effects to making a move like this. It's possible that the district attorneys would not want to use grand juries if the counties had to bear the costs, in which case we may see a big increase in the number of preliminary hearings. It would add a cost to the DAs, it would add a cost to defense counsel, it would also add costs to the trial courts. And if there were enough of them, it could wipe out the savings here. But it's something that we need to look at. There are other ways to deal with that problem. Lane County has been able to have a dramatic reduction in their grand juror use by reaching agreement between prosecutors and defense counsel to stipulate information and waive indictment, not in every case, but and they're often able to accomplish that. It's one way to look for efficiencies in the system. There are pros and cons to this. We would just like to open the discussion on it. Next, I'd like to direct you to sections 32 through 37. Under current statute, we must provide to other governmental entities services, copies, and data at no cost, and other governmental entities are allowed to defer filing fees when they appear in our courts. The same silent cost arguments and impacts to the department that I just discussed apply here. The Judicial Department pays assessments to the Department of Administrative Services, the Department of Justice, the Secretary of State, and so on. This would set up a similar system for those who come to use our services. Paying for services, as we all know, tends to make people more cost-conscious in how they use those services and forces them to become more efficient. Again, there are pros and cons to this, but we think it's worthy of discussion given the current budget situation. Next, I'd like to go to sections 21 through 25, the Certified Shorthand Reporter Program, CSR. You heard testimony on that yesterday. It's really important that we emphasize we do not advocate ending this program. That is not our intent, nor are we setting them up to end them in the future. The purpose here is to change a lot of the shalls to mays in those statutes to give us flexibility in administering the program. The program is not self-supporting. There is expense to the Judicial Department for processing education compliance, testing, staffing the committee, scheduling, drafting, editing, and finalizing policy, and all the things that go along with that. The court reporters were very generous in offering to go to an annual fee versus a biannual fee, but I have to tell you that still would not cover the costs that we incur in this program. There's some rigidity in the statute, especially when it comes to their committee, where there's rigidity in the membership so that we haven't been able to actually have that type of committee. I don't know that the committee has ever had a public member, although that is required by statute, and we found it difficult to maintain the two bar members on the committee. That's one of the areas where we'd like some flexibility in dealing with this. We have another program, Court Interpreter Certification Program, and we run it in a similar manner to that. For certification, we would look at using national certification. Contrary to the impression you may have gotten yesterday, those court reporters who have national certification were mandated to take testing to get that certification. They can't have the certification if they didn't take testing. We would like to submit some additional written information on the points that were raised yesterday, so we'll give that in writing to the committee so that you'll have that as we move this bill along. Next, I'd like to go to the juror per diem in sections 26 and 27. I doubt that you're going to hear from anyone on this. The jurors aren't going to come in here. But I wanted to discuss this because this is something that we have strongly advocated for many years, increased juror fees. And I think it was in 01 we were able to get an increase for the third day forward up to $50 a day. Immediately in 02, during the special sessions, that had to be scaled back to $25 a day. So as constructed now, jurors are paid $10 for the first day, $10 for the second day, $25 for all days thereafter. We don't want to reduce their fees, but we need to be able to maintain our core constitutional function of providing jury trials to all the citizens of this state in civil and criminal matters. If we reduce the fee to a straight $10 per day, we believe we would have a savings of up to $1.2 million, depending on the number of trials that are held. Again, that would be the equivalent of about 2 months of juror trials with interpreters statewide. A number of the amendments in here deal with flexibility, and what they are doing is changing shall to may. We are not trying to eliminate all those various programs that we discuss in this amendment. We are trying to seek latitude in how and when we accomplish the tasks and programs that we have. These are valuable programs. We like them. We just need to be able to deal with them under this budget circumstance. There's a lot more that I could discuss in going through these amendments. I'd be happy to go through them section by section, but I'm also happy to let you rely on my written testimony on this.
All right. Colleagues, what I think I want to do, I understand that Commissioner Bernard has another appointment that he needs to make. I'm going to go ahead and take the testimony, then open it up for more discussion, because I at this point think that there may be some, specific questions you may want to ask Mr. Miller, but instead of getting weighed down on that, let's get the other testimony in first. So, Paul, I'm not sure if you or Commissioner is going to go first.
Mr. Chair, I can defer to the Commissioner given his time constraint.
All right. Commissioner Bernard.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Jim Bernard, new Clackamas County Commissioner. We now have five county commissioners, and we're excited to have the opportunity to be down here. And thank you for giving me a moment to suggest that our DA departments are already underfunded. Our Clackamas County DA will be down over $350,000 this year, and we're going to have to backfill. I spent my day yesterday in our community corrections. We're over $400,000 short. So shifting fees or costs to our other departments, I just don't know what we're going to do to move forward. The system seems to be falling apart. Our jails are full. We have no funding for them, no funding for courts, no funding for community corrections. Frankly, the system needs some help, and we're committed to working with the Judicial Department to find out any way we can to cut costs and streamline the system and make it a valuable resource to our citizens and to the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. And we're appearing this morning in support of some provisions of the Dash 2 amendments and in opposition to others. Let's deal with the opposition issues first. On Section 28, the grand jury costs, and Sections 32 to 37 on charging local governments for the cost of services that are now provided by the courts are basically a cost shift. It's just plain and simple that, and I'm concerned that to do that in the abstract and to do it in isolation of other considerations is not good public policy. The governor created a work group, a governor's task force, 8 months ago to deal with the declining revenues in the county forest payments. And that work group delivered a report, a copy of which I believe many of you already have. It shows on the cover in red the counties that are in critical condition, critical. And in other colors, it shows counties that would, within 4 years, become critical without an increase in revenues from the federal forest payments. Those federal forest payments were restored on a declining basis for a four-year period in October of last year. At the same time, we all know what happened to the state general fund. But that restoration is a declining source of revenue, so that after the fourth year, we'll be in the same position, critical once again, unless other things happen. But the problem with dealing with these issues in the abstract, in isolation of other considerations, is that we have one state agency, one state department, one state branch of government, recommending suggestions that don't address the critical nature of the individual counties and whether or not they have the capacity to pick up that cost. And the fact of the matter is that most counties, they don't. It seems an appropriate approach, rather, is to work together to do things such as things that are listed in Sections 28A to Section 30 on increasing the collection capacity of the Judicial Department on outstanding debts and obligations. We work together with the Judicial Department and with this legislature in order to persuade Congress to allow federal income tax refunds to be withheld and delivered to the state in the event that the courts have outstanding obligations that that individual owes. That's the kind of collaborative approach that I think we should be taking. And I would suggest to the committee, and I've suggested to the Judicial Department, that at that time the nexus exists with respect to federal income tax refunds, and why can't it also exist with respect to other benefits that people would otherwise receive from local governments and other obligations that people would otherwise owe to local governments. So say, for example, it might be possible to marry the outstanding debt obligation with the property tax system or with building code system. But basically, if somebody has an outstanding obligation to the state of Oregon, it's in the form of a judgment, and that person is seeking some benefit from government at any level, then perhaps we ought to consider something in there that provides for the payment of that debt obligation before that benefit is bestowed. And we'd be glad to work with the Judicial Department in doing that. Sections 32 to 37, of course, we've already covered those. Those are the issues that involved another cost shift from the Judicial Department to local governments in terms of the filing fees and other costs that are currently borne. With respect to Section 43 of the Grand Jury Inspection of Correctional Facilities, I think we would agree with that. County governing bodies are already on the hook for unlawful conditions of confinement in correctional facilities, and there are a lot of other people out there more than happy to point out any defects that they find. They don't need the grand jury to do it. I have lots of civil rights lawyers who would be happy to take on that role on their behalf. Section 44, develop workable rules for consolidation of probation violations. We'd be happy to work with the Judicial Department on that issue as well. The point of all this, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, is simply to say that shifting a cost from one level of government to another is not the answer to the same problems that we all share at this point. It's working together to try to identify cost savings and streamlining government so we can still deliver the essential services to our members.
All right. First, what I want to do is give the committee an opportunity to ask questions of Commissioner Bernard first, so he can leave when he needs to leave. I believe he needs to leave close to 9 o'clock. So are there any questions specifically for the commissioner?
If I think mine applies to the commissioner.
Okay. That's a request.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And let me preface it. So the commissioner, because commissioner wasn't part of the discussions, and he can say is in the general fund side, we face something like a potential 30% cut. For whatever reason, right now we're treating other funds kind of in a vacuum, which is kind of like having a salmonella poison jar of peanut butter that, you know, we don't know if we're allergic to peanuts. We know we're going to die when we open it, and we're going to get sick regardless when we open it. Having said that, the President of the Senate and Senator Carter, the co-chair of the Ways and Means, told a group of us earlier this week that structural reform, cost savings, and those sorts of things that would help the budget are the responsibility of the policy committee. So here's a bill in which we're talking about doing significant reforms in the Judiciary Department. We've identified, or they've identified and said, that there are some areas like Section 28, specifically we'll say the grand juries, where there's going to be some cost efficiencies. Commissioner, I mean, you're elected, we're elected, everybody else up there is not elected. Is there, do you see there's an ability to sit down with the district attorneys, the commissioners, with the Judicial Department, at least find some common ground where we can work through some of these issues? Because I think the one thing the co-chair did say, shared pain, shared responsibility, but you're right, we can't throw it all to you guys because it doesn't work. But do you see common enough ground to get the DAs, the commissioners, the Judiciary Department to work through some of these issues quickly, like in the next week or 10 days?
Well, I am a member of the AOC Public Safety Committee. I'll certainly ask the committee to consider that. I think so. I know that I'm learning a lot very fast, and we have a lot of tough issues ahead of us, and we're looking at every way we can possibly streamline government and make it more efficient. So, yes. I'll address it today at our Public Safety Committee meeting.
Follow-up?
Yes.
Sure. And with the Commissioner President, all right, Justice Department, what's your response?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, of course, we're always willing to work with everyone on these, all of these concepts. On the grand juror one, the other party that needs to come to the table are the defense lawyers, because they will be involved in whatever efficiencies we can come up with in this system.
I'll ask them the same question when they come up.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. I'll open up the panel for general questions, if there's any questions. I got Senator Wissett raised his hand first. Oh, he's just flexing his mouse. Just stretching. Okay, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to put a comment on the record with response to something that Mr. Snyder said about the increased collection efforts, and we have had discussions in this committee about particularly the federal tax refunds, and you talked about extending the ability to collect from people in other areas, and I just want to make sure that we're cautious in our discussions in that regard, because understanding and appreciating the need to collect those funds, we have to be aware that many of the funds that people are receiving are exempt, for example, veterans benefits or Social Security benefits. And we've had discussions in our Consumer Protection Committee about what's involved if those funds are garnished and what happens to people because they're living on those benefits and then they end up having to go reverse the transaction. So I appreciate the need to look at this, but we need to do so carefully to make sure that we aren't taking money that people are living on that's exempt and then having to figure out how to reverse that if it's been garnished. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I agree with you completely. some of the comments that I made about specifics will come as news to our members, frankly. But the concept behind that, simply to say, let's look together for other ways that we can increase the effectiveness of the collection effort, stands. That's something that we can do. The specifics of it, I think we just need to brainstorm together to come up with things that don't violate the issues that you've raised, but still provide for collections of outstanding judgments.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions?
I have a follow-up.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chair, and I was respectful that the Commissioner might have to bolt and one of the other members might want to do it, but I just wanted to put on the record for the Judiciary Department who came and addressed this, Harold, is I do have concerns in Section 1, and which is one of the fee areas, 22 through 25. I'm sure I'll get all kinds of email on this one, but this is the recorder program. I need someone to educate me in the future on we're electronically and we're digital recording and so on and so forth, why we're still doing it by shorthand, and could these valuable employees be utilized in a more efficient manner somewhere else in the system? And likewise, Section 28, I'm challenged by passing the buck to the counties because either we got to pay or they got to pay or we got to find a better way. And Section 42, I'm also challenged with. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And Senator Boquist, I'll answer part of that. First of all, my understanding, we do not have court reporters that actually do shorthand. They do still do, as Senator Walker has done in her career, basically take it off of a, I guess, lack of better terms, a steno's transcription machine. And if you want to know as to the pros and cons as to having a live person recording, I would refer you to Senator Wissett, who could probably spend hours explaining a situation that he investigated down in his county of Klamath. So, but we won't do that on the record today. So, with
I'll
that,
let my good senior senator from my side of the aisle come over and convince me.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I address Senator Boquist's concerns on Section 1?
You may.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, when we began the e-court process to develop the e-court, we put into statute that the chief could specifically set up rules for that, and we felt that that was sufficient to also allow him to set up a system for usage fees on the system, much as occurs in federal court, to make that system, to the extent possible, self-funded. LFO disagrees with us, I believe, whether the authority extends that far. And to help us move forward with that program, we're proposing to add fees into the chief's powers here so that we can continue to work on how that system will work. And that would apply both to the future system at the trial court level and to the existing system that we're building at the appellate court level. As to the certified court shorthand court reporters, we're happy to come and talk with you about that. We have people who understand the situation very well. Thank you.
Just so the Judiciary Department or the Chief Justice doesn't think I'm centering him out, I have a philosophical problem with fees that are simply pushed into the budget. I've spent at least the last 3 months trying to get the executive branch to identify the sources of other funds with the cooperation of LFO and LRRO, and I'm having a tough time, not with your department, but with other agencies, identifying where they come from and where they're spent. And so I'm just challenged by that. It's not your department. It's just across the board. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
I've got Brad Berry. And, Brad, I see Dan Norris is here. Did Dan want to come up with you or...
Apparently not.
We're here to serve.
Come on, right. Now, come on, Brad. I just all but said I support your position on part of this here, so perhaps I'll keep my testimony short.
Don't say anything that can change that.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, my name is Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I, too, chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. I would first like to say about this bill that I applaud the Judicial Department for looking at various ways to find cost savings. And I also applaud the Judicial Department for being upfront with members or other people in the public who are affected by some of these proposals, taking the time to meet with myself personally, but in particular the DA's Association, about Section 28 and being very upfront about that many of these are ideas or suggestions that are coming to the committee for review. If I might give you just a brief history, in the 80s, the state took over basically the court role of taking on the cost of courts and the running of the courts. And at that time, there was a partnership which was brokered relating to many things related to the court system. In addition to taking the courts, the state took on the cost of indigent defense, left the cost of prosecution primarily with the counties. However, at least at the time, it was put forth that this would be a partnership between the state and the counties for the cost of prosecution. As you know, as time has gone on, the state through, and I don't think it's at all mean-spirited, but as we have reached budget problems in the past, the sharing of costs of prosecution by the state with the counties has diminished to the point where, really, other than the payment of the state elected official, the district attorney, the state has very little participation in the costs of prosecution at this time. One of the things that the prosecution does do that, of course, impacts state costs is we utilize the court system. And the grand jury is a function of the court. To remind those of you who are fortunate enough to not be attorneys on the committee, all felonies are required to be reviewed by an impartial arbiter. That is either the court through a preliminary hearing or through the grand jury process where the case is reviewed by 7 lay members of the public who make up the grand jury. Every felony has to go through there. The courts have stated that in part their suggestion here is based upon the fact that the state has control over the grand jury resources, how much we use them and utilize them, and that's in part true. I would suggest, though, that that's not literally different than our control of trial jury costs, because ultimately cases that we file, cases that we can't resolve that go to trial, drive the cost primarily of the juries at the trial level. This is a cost of administering justice, and the cost at the grand jury level is no different. Back in, I think it was in the late 80s, I was not district attorney at the time, and I believe the case was called the Friedland case. The Oregon Supreme Court determined that the district attorney's offices would need to have specific plans in place showing which cases would go to grand jury versus which cases would go before a preliminary hearing. The argument made by the defense in that case was that the state was arbitrarily choosing which cases went which path. In the aftermath of the Friedland case, rather than run arguments of arbitrariness, most district attorney's offices in this state moved everything to preliminary hearing. I would suggest to you that that is the most efficient use of our resources by having cases in grand jury. I'm sorry. Thank you. Glad Dan's here. Taking all cases to grand jury. The time is shorter. The method by which we have witnesses come in, they don't have to come in specific order and presented by case, although that's usually the case. We can move cases in and out of grand jury quickly. I would also tell you that at least in my experience and my discussions with the judiciary who used to do preliminary hearings, they are very happy that preliminary hearings are no longer part of their workload. One of the unintended consequences that Section 28 might have is to push district attorneys to once again review whether or not they want to take certain cases to grand jury to reduce their costs for which cases they would push to preliminary hearing to reduce their costs of grand jury. That may well be an unintended consequence. The Judiciary Department does, however, look at that and say, okay, what would those costs be? And I would respectfully disagree with their kind of end result on where that would end up. Because what would happen in a county like mine, let's say we just took half of our felonies and ran them by preliminary hearing, it might reduce my grand jury costs by half, but it would literally require an additional judge in our county to handle all of those cases going to preliminary hearing. That's not what I want to do. I'm suggesting, though, that it could cause a result that we don't really want to happen, an inefficiency in the overall criminal justice system, which could be caused by pushing grand jury costs down to the district attorneys. When I met with members of the trial court about this particular section,
and I had some thoughts about how we might be able to move to reduce grand jury costs overall. And Senator Boquist made the comment about, well, what can we all sit down and talk about, are there ways that we can reduce these costs overall? One, as you might guess, we're opposed to a cost shift, moving from one governmental entity, the cost, to another governmental entity, wherein, in fact, both governmental entities are hurting in this particular economy. But secondly, we are more than willing to be at the table with some proposals, and in fact might be a statutory proposal, which could aid in reducing the cost of grand jury. I mentioned it to Mr. Factor when we met the other day, and to Ms. Cozine, an idea I had. Part of my problem is I meet with the ODAA Executive Committee in about 2 hours, and I'm a little reluctant to kind of float it out here without running it by my colleagues. But I think there are ways that we can go forward to help reduce those costs, which will maybe not eliminate the $1.3 million per year or per biennium that they think they could save here, but would in fact help save grand jury costs. And we, as an association, are more than willing to sit at the table and have those discussions.
Great.
Questions? Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brad, you don't get to answer this question. You can't answer this.
I can't answer.
Your colleague to your left can answer this. Because he represents all 36 counties. You just kind of represent my county. We're presently, and let me just reiterate, and you heard the testimony with the Chief Justice's representatives up here, and you heard my comments and what the President of the Senate said and what the co-chair from the Senate side said, and we're facing huge cuts, and we have a bill here that talks about basically reform and restructuring, so on and so forth like that. One, I'm looking for a commitment from the President of the Association that you're willing to come to the table and participate. And the second thing is I do want to comment in that, because we constantly hear, well, we can't cut money here, we can't cut money there, you know, it's going to be an injustice, so on and so forth. But the fact remains, in all my counties, there is a matrix of some sort behind the scenes in which we ration justice now, because the district attorneys cannot afford to prosecute all time crimes. I believe in the county in which I have 6 voters to the south of me, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Chair, has a fairly significant list of crimes that they're unable to prosecute because of financial constraints right now. So we're already rationing justice. So it seems like we all need to sit down at the table and come up with a better plan of shared pain and shared responsibility. Because we can talk about justice, but we're already rationing it. So your comment, one, about coming to the table, and two, I mean, we're justifying rationing, so what do we do next?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, we are rationing, and we are making decisions that do, in fact, endanger the public when
Dan,
we ration it.
I need you to put your name on the record.
Oh, excuse me. I'm Dan Norris, District Attorney in Malheur County. Sorry, Mr. Chair. We are always willing to come to the table, and I know Brad Berry has come up with an idea specifically on the grand jury that he does want to float it by the executive committee, but it has the potential to save significant costs across the system, including witness fees, grand jury fees, still protects the defendant's rights if they choose that they want to have a grand jury or a preliminary hearing, but for the most part can be done very quickly. It may delay justice about 10 to 20 days in a case where the defendant decides to exercise those rights. So we're willing to try to come up with those ideas, talk to our partners and folks who have an interest, and try to make justice cheaper so we don't have to ration it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions, comments?
Mr. Chair, if I might, one other comment that I neglected to mention before. Currently, the district attorneys do share in the costs of grand jury, and that includes that we currently pay interpreter costs. That's not a small number, especially for the large counties. The argument, and we've had the internal discussions, well, if this is a court function, which we genuinely believe it is, why are the courts not paying for the cost of interpreters just like they do at trial? Mm-hmm. But we have, to date, I don't know of any county that has pushed back with their county trial court administrator and said, you know, you ought to be picking up these costs, and then we get into that particular debate internally. But I did want to point out, without stepping away from this table, that we do share those costs.
All right, thank you. Before you leave, I do have one, question for you, and it's really for Melanie, who's sitting with us. As I told the audience earlier, she is an intern today with my office, just met her this morning. She's at OSU. She's a junior. her aspirations is to be a prosecuting attorney. And I'm wondering if there are still internship-type programs in the summer, not that I've talked to her about this, that might be open, that she could check in with your association to see whether she could actually maybe help out in an office, maybe you can get a good prosecutor in the future.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Melanie, congratulations on picking an excellent university, I might point out, to begin with. apologies, Chair.
I went to land grant school myself.
Okay. The interesting thing is we have interns in my office. I can't afford to pay them. But the benefits of interning in a prosecutor's office, and especially your ability, law students, to get into court regularly and get that experience is a great experience. I have two colleges in my jurisdiction, Linfield and George Fox University, and we routinely have interns who volunteer in our office, and we try to make that experience as broad as we can for the interns. So the short answer is yes, we are always anxious to have, especially college students, step up and say, look, I'd like to volunteer and help in your office. And I think most of the DAs have the same attitude I do. What can we do in exchange for that to give you the broadest experience possible?
Thank you.
Have
a good day. And was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 256? Not seeing one, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 256. And, Council, where do we want to go now?
You want to go back to Senate Bill 928.
All right, we're back to reopening Senate Bill 928. And I don't have that. Courtney's here.
All right, I've got a number of people who are here to
testify. Looks like everyone that's signed up is will be testifying in support. Sybil, I'd like for you to come forward. And do you have a group that you want it to be with you?
If Senator Lapata and Jane Downing could come up with me, that would be great.
Okay, that'd be great.
Federal, though.
Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of Senate Bill 928. Very much appreciate the committee's attention to this issue. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Oregon Law Center as well as on behalf of the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women. As you all know, the Law Center is a statewide nonprofit that provides free legal assistance to low-income people. Our mission is to help achieve access to justice for our clients. We have significantly and increasingly become aware of the number of problems that our clients who are victims of domestic violence or sexual assault suffer in the workplace. And we've become increasingly aware of the importance of protections for people suffering from those issues. And so we have put forward Senate Bill 928 with the support of our allies to try to take one important step in addressing the issue of domestic violence in the workplace. In summary, overall, and then I'll go through the bill in more detail, but in summary, the bill would simply provide that victimization is not a basis upon which an employer should be allowed to discriminate. So the bill would prohibit discrimination against employees on that basis, and it would require that employers make reasonable safety accommodations to address concerns related to domestic or sexual violence or stalking unless the accommodations would impose an undue hardship on the employer. I'll go through the bill. I believe you have a summary, and you should also have the bill in front of you, and then I'll tell you a little bit more about why we're concerned and why we think this bill is such a great impact on our clients. Essentially, the bill protects all employees who would be victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking, and if requested by a victim, it would require employers to make reasonable safety accommodations. Safety accommodations could include things like transfers or reassignments, modified schedules, leave from employment, a changed work telephone number or workstation, installed locks, and other safety adjustments. The type of reasonable accommodation that we expect to come up will depend on the circumstances. An example that I have seen in my work with clients is I used to work in the Benz legal aid office, and there is a small salon across the street from a Starbucks coffee shop, which had a great glass front window, as did the salon. My client was a victim, had gotten a protection order against the perpetrator, done all of the things that she could do to try to resolve the safety issue. The perpetrator would sit in the Starbucks window right across the street and stare at the victim through the window. He was not prohibited from going to the Starbucks, which was a public place, but it had a significant impact on her and her ability to do her job because he was right there and she could see him. So the employer was able to transfer her so that she had a desk that was away from the window and she could not be viewed. That took care of the concern. After a few weeks, he went away. Everything went back to normal. But that small change made a big, significant difference for that employee in that circumstance. And it was a reasonable, it was a good impact and a good outcome for all, for the whole employer and for all of the employees in that workplace, because a potential danger was resolved and the workplace could continue to be a productive place. So to go forward in summarizing the bill, accommodations would only be required if they were requested by an employee, and if requested by the employer, the employee must provide certification, aka documentation, that the employee qualifies for the relief. That is, that the employee is a victim of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking, and that they need this safety accommodation. Certification under the bill is identified as it is in previous laws that this legislature has passed to mean a copy of a police report or a copy of a protective order or other court order or documentation from an attorney or a law enforcement officer or health care professional or a mental health professional, a clergy member, or a victim service provider. And victim service provider is identified, defined in current statute to mean a nonprofit domestic violence or sexual assault service provider or a victim's assistance advocate at the DA's office. So these are the mechanisms by which the employer can implement the law and assure him or herself that the victim does in fact qualify for the relief. The bill provides that any documentation submitted would be maintained and confidential unless released with permission. Enforcement, to answer Senator Boquist's question, is in two ways. It's through the Department of Bureau of Labor and Industries. There's also a civil cause of action that is provided. Essentially, the bill is fit into the current structures of enforcement for our other discrimination laws. For example, we have a provision that prohibits discrimination against employees for filing a workers' compensation claim or for participating in civil or criminal court proceedings. Those, the relief that we, or the enforcement mechanisms that we have provided for this bill are similar to those statutes. So we think the bill's good public policy for a number of reasons. Number one, unfortunately, domestic and sexual violence is a big problem in the state of Oregon, as it is across the nation. It's a public health and a public safety problem. It costs our state untold dollars. $50 million is the most recent estimate per year in Oregon. Obviously, it has a huge impact on victims and their families. And the reason that we're concerned about providing protection specifically within the workplace is that economic safety is one of the key indicators, economic security is one of the key indicators to whether or not a victim will be able to take steps to get safe and will be able to stay safe. If a job is lost or economic security is not available, victims can't protect themselves, they can't protect their children, often they are forced to return home to an abuser, they have no other choice. So we think that economic security is a key factor in helping people to take steps to make to make themselves safe. Unfortunately, the workplace is too often not a friendly place to victims, and when judgments are made about a victim based on the behavior of illegal acts of a third party over whom they have no control, that's unfair. It's bad public policy. It also has a negative, it just sets a negative standard for society as a whole if victims have to suffer that additional consequence. We also know from experience in other states that employers, and in Oregon, that employers have a very important role to play in helping to address this issue. They have an economic interest in making sure to try to make their workplaces safe, both for employee productivity concerns, but also in terms of making sure that their employees are safe and that coworkers of victims are safe. And so taking steps to address domestic and sexual violence is a good business policy. It's the right thing to do. We also know that reasonable safety accommodations can be very simple, very inexpensive, very modest, and they can make a big difference. The bill is reasonable in its approach because if the reasonable accommodation would have too much of an impact on the employer is exempt from the application of the law. The only two other points that I wanted to make are that this protection that would be provided under Senate Bill 928 echoes protection that is currently applicable to all state agencies via an executive order issued in 2007. That order prohibits discrimination and it also requires reasonable accommodation. Those definitions are echo one another. So it's a determination and a protection that's already available to state employees. This bill would extend that protection to all employees in the state of Oregon. The bill is also in keeping with Senate Bill 946, which was passed by this legislature last session, which allows leave from work in particular circumstances to allow people to go to court and seek medical care and other safety-related issues. So we think this is an important step forward for Oregon, which has done really good work on this issue, and it fits into the package of protection that we hope will be available to all victims. So we very much appreciate your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. We'll take testimony from everyone before we open up for questions. Whoever wants to go next.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Jane Downing, and I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service. And I've been working with victims and survivors of domestic and sexual violence for 18 years now and have been privileged to do trainings all around the Northwest, have trained about 25,000 people to date, have trained thousands of employers and employees who many of them have talked to me about the circumstances under which a bill like this would have been very helpful to them. And I'm going to tell you a few of those stories and just let you know the impact that this might have for individuals within our communities to make a difference. I talked to one employee who had been sexually assaulted by another employee, and she had reached out to her employer and said, "Can you help me with some simple safety measures that will just help me be able to retain my position here?" And that employer refused to do that. And she lost her job, which she loved, and it meant the world to her to do the kind of work she was doing. And she struggled for many months to find other employment and ultimately was underemployed and was not doing a job that she had the same passion for and desire to do. And so that employer and employee missed out on having that individual who added so much to the workplace. Another situation, I talked to an employer who actually was attending one of my trainings on domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. And what he said to me after the training was, "I now realize that we had a long-term employee who left our employ because we didn't have the most basic things in place to help support that employee. We could have done more." And so they had a situation where they now realized, oh, you know, we really could have been there for that person, and we lost that employee, and we had to train someone else to come into that position. And then I talked with an employee who talked about an employer who had made a difference for them. This individual had been late to work because her abuser would try to damage her car in certain ways, would not pick up the children on time, and her employer sat down with her and said, "You know, I think we can do some things with flexing your schedule so that you can not have the situation where you're worried about, can I be in on time and am I going to lose my job?" And I think that's the key thing that I want you all to hear, is that you will have individuals who could stay in employment, have that economic security, continue to be well-meaning employees, do all the right things, that if employers just do a few protections, put a few things in place, will make all the difference for someone having that security. And what we know from doing this work is that victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking are some of the most vulnerable individuals in our community and usually are raising families. And by having that security in place that they can say, at least I can keep my job, it will make all the difference for them continuing to be productive members of society, lead towards self-sufficiency, and have employers and employees be able to have employees that are ultimately going to say, I'm going to stay in this employer's place of work because they kind of walk on water. They make all the difference for me in the world. They were there for me at a very difficult time in my life. So our hope is that you will see in Senate Bill 928 some steps that can be taken through the good work that has already taken place, as Sybil said, to be sure that those individuals who need that support will have it from their employers in the state of Oregon. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.
Hi, good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Cassandra Skinner-Lapata, and I'm here under three roles. I'm one person, but I'm wearing three hats today. My first hat is a small business owner. I am a founding partner of a three-attorney law firm down in Eugene. I'm also a family law practitioner full-time, and I am a survivor of domestic violence. My first role as small business owner, SB 928 provides the needed protections for employers as well as employees and other persons in that workforce. As small business owners, there is this portion of the bill that addresses undue hardship to employers and making reasonable accommodations for employees. And as previously stated, reasonable accommodations could be anything from modifying a schedule or modifying the place of station of that employee's work. And so it is up to that employee to make the request. I believe that employers are generally worried about the safety of their employees and their workforce. Personally, from while researching the location for my business and where to start this firm, I was looking for an ADA compliant building for ramps and doorways that were large enough for chair access and all the other things that make this ADA compliant. But I also was really concerned about a windowless meeting room and a back door for access for either domestic violence survivors and clients of mine to be able to leave, or for employees to be able to leave without being accessed by the street or being viewed that way. And that is my role as an employer to keep my workforce safe. As far as my role as a family law attorney, I have seen, I think I counted between 8 and 10% of my caseload deals with survivors, victims of domestic violence, stalking, and sexual assault, and their issues with employment and employability, and based on the victimization that they are receiving. As Ms. Hebb has stated, continued employment is crucial for my clients to continue to provide safe housing, food, being able to stay safe from their abusers during the legal process and the ability to receive adequate legal assistance during the proceeding. So that's where I am as a family law attorney. I have actually one current client who has an 8-to-5 job. She's dealing with a very abusive soon-to-be ex-husband. Her work, her original schedule was from 8-to-5. Her work realized she was dealing with court proceedings and meetings with attorneys and trying to get her family on state aid, meeting with WIC, meeting with DHS, getting on OHP and food stamps because of some loss of income from her husband. And this employer just modified her schedule, was able to let her come in, even a change of 1 hour, start at 9 or even at 10 during the morning, and that allowed her the 2 hours of business time to get her personal business done, and that was crucial for her family and the safety for her family. Now, the third hat I'm wearing is actually as a domestic violence survivor here today, and my own personal experience is that I had fled my situation, my domestic violence situation, while I had been a stay-at-home mother. I had two small children under the age of five, and I was pregnant with my third. And I sought, instead of seeking employment, being pregnant, being dealing with this major crisis in my life, shuffling around to these different agencies and knowing how taxing that was for my schedule, I chose to further get into schooling and training that way. But doing so, I created my reliance on state aid, on food stamps and OHP and the like, whereas if I had been employed, if I had felt the ability to be employed at that time, then I think my reliance on state aid would not have been nearly as great. My ability to keep my family safe, to continue my freedom from my abusive ex-husband was purely reliant on my ability to provide for my family, provide their food, provide their housing, and provide their health care, and whether it was through state aid or through employment. And I think the state would have benefited greatly if I had been employed at that time rather than relying so much on state aid. And I think that's true of many of my clients, and that's true of many, many survivors today. So I welcome questions.
All right, thank you. Open up for questions. I'm going to start with Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think Sybil can kind of address these, and I'm supportive of the bill. I have a question on, well, point of reference first, and that's in line 25. There's Scrivener's error, and we're not talking about watches. I couldn't find it. That goes to watches. We're actually talking about undue hardship, which is 659A121. Three things stand up in line 7 and 8 for clarification here. We talk about transfer, reassignment, and then in the next line, leave from an employment. Are we talking about paid leave from an employment, unpaid leave? And then can we address, I guess for the record, whether the record counts, transfer and reassignment, especially in the case of a small business where pretty hard for a legal counsel to transfer themselves as someplace, or there's only three employees. And can we kind of expand upon that so that there's something in the record that talks about what is undue hardship down below?
Absolutely. Chair Przanski and Senator Boquist, members of the committee, first of all, I'm embarrassed to say that I have read line 25 on page 1 a million times and did not notice until last night when Cass, Ms. Skinner-Lapata, mentioned it to me. So thank you for the eagle eyes, and we'll get that taken care of.
Watch repair under the statute.
It's embarrassing, I guess. So to get to your question about the reasonable accommodation definition, I think that, number one, there's no requirement that leave be paid. There's no requirement that leave be provided. It's really just about what is the accommodation that might meet the needs of the survivor in that circumstance, and is the employer able to provide that accommodation, or would it be an undue hardship? And undue hardship is defined, incorrectly referred to 695A, but it's meant to be 659A121, which is the definition of undue hardship for the purposes of the application of other employment statutes. And that analysis takes into account many of the factors that you just mentioned. What's the overall size of the employer? What is the number of employees? What is the function of the job? And they make a distinction between the size of the employer and the size of the facility. So you might have a small outstationed office of a larger employer, but maybe with respect to that particular small office, something may not be as workable as it would be for a much larger office in that same employer. So the definition of undue hardship is fleshed out in 659A.121, and I hope that answers your question.
Close up, Mr.
Right. Good enough. Any other questions? I have one comment that I'd like to just put on, and it really goes under the reasonable safety accommodations as well. My reading of this, the way it's worded, it currently says includes, and then it names off all these different things. It seems to me, instead of saying includes exclusively, it should maybe be could include, because the concern I have when I look at this is it does talk about stuff such as installing locks, implementing safety procedures. I mean, the procedures, I can see where that could be accommodated, but if we're talking about making changes in the physical structure of the building, and whatever that might mean, I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but what I just think I heard was that these are suggested possible changes based on the request, based on the ability to accommodate and all that. I know that, so I think that's one word we probably would want to insert, or something that makes certain that it doesn't become an arguable fact in court that this is required as it's defined.
That's clearly our intent. We talked to the council about the drafting of that, and we're informed that if there's a list like that,
it doesn't mean all of those things. It just could mean those things, they're suggestions as opposed to requirements, but certainly we'd be happy to clarify that.
Senator Boquist and I want to make sure the record reflects.
I'm
make certain that it is intended as you've said. And so we'll let Elsie look at this and see if we can maybe make it for the layperson who's reading this after this hearing a little bit more clear. Senator Whitsett.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski. I still need a little more convincing on this bill. Prospective versus mandatory. Undue hardship being decided by BOLI and by civil action in court. I was supportive of the bill last session of requiring employees to provide adequate time without pay for their employees to deal with their own personal problems regarding sexual violence and so forth. But when we start requiring employers to do certain things within their business in order to provide relief for their employer's personal problems, when we start requiring that, that's a divide I'm not sure I want to cross over. And I think that when you require an employer to make changes that could be disruptive or to accommodate an employee's personal difficulty, that's no fault of the employer. I struggle with that. I understand what you're trying to get at, and I think it's a laudable cause, but I'm not sure that it is the employer's responsibility to deal proactively with a personal problem of the employee that is not caused and has no fault, the employer has no fault in creating.
Senator Chair Pozanski, Senator Whitsett, I think from our perspective, and I agree, employer bears no fault here, but employers, I think, have a duty and an obligation to maintain safe workplaces for their employees, for all of their employees. I think that part of the justification from our perspective is that if we know that if employees know that discrimination is prohibited and that it's okay for them to ask for these accommodations, they're more likely to come forward and disclose if there is an issue that may present a danger to the employer and to other employees in the workplace. And so it's sort of a risk mitigation.
This bill doesn't say that the employer... That doesn't say that the employee has the right to do that without retribution from the employer. What it says is that the employer may have to make accommodations. I mean, I don't have a problem with asking, but I do have I may have a problem with the Bureau of Labor and Industries and the courts deciding what is appropriate for a businessman to do in his own business in order to accommodate the problem, the personal problem of an employee.
Senator Pozanski, Senator Whitsett, I think that both pieces of that protection are important from our perspective, because we do think that if there is and the undue hardship application is meant to provide protection for employers so that their duty or their burden is not too great, and I think the benefit to employers as well as all of the employees in the workplace, if the danger is mitigated, is it's a policy choice, but we think that benefit outweighs the...
That may follow up.
I just want to get a time check here. We've got about 18 minutes. We've got three more people on this panel that I know. We got one other bill, so I'd like to kind of start wrapping up. And if you want to put it on the record...
I would just like to say one other thing. I think it is really the employer's responsibility and right to decide whether it's going to be a better thing for the employer or not. Not Bowley, not the civil courts, but the employer is it should be able to decide whether, in their mind, whether this is a good thing or not for them. Thank you.
All right, so what we're going to do, and you may want to circle around with some of the members and have further discussion. Of course, the bill is not going to be moving forward today, but we do want to get all the testimony. So, ladies, thank you very much for coming forward and giving us your testimony. I have three other people that are scheduled, Mel Cohn, Bob Esterbrook, and Christine Herman. And knowing our time restraints, if you could be succinct, that would be wonderful.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the Acting Director of the Public Health Division at the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to speak in support of this bill. What I have to add to the eloquent testimony you've already heard is a couple of comments about the big picture here. Violence between intimate partners is a very serious public health problem. In 2001 through 2002, when we did a survey, our survey indicated that almost 25,000 Oregon women had experienced a physical or sexual assault, a physical assault by an intimate partner, and almost 9,000 had experienced a sexual assault in the last year. So, from my perspective, the frequency of this problem dwarfs many of the other issues that we already, rightly so, consider very serious for the health of women. For example, the frequency of new diagnoses of breast cancer is about 10 times less frequent than the frequency of this kind of violence. So this is a very big problem. The victimization has very substantial effects as well. In our survey, roughly a quarter of the physically assaulted women told us that they had been knocked unconscious, 11% had bones broken or joints dislocated, and 6% suffered knife wounds or lacerations. The psychological scars as well are very, very serious and long-lasting. So from my perspective, this is a very important problem, and it simply isn't right that women should have to choose between their health and safety and their continued employment. In a way, having to do that re-victimizes these women who have already suffered. We also have some data on lost productivity from this kind of violence. The numbers are very large, again, in your testimony. $3.7 million for sexual assault, $5.5 million due to physical assault. So these are very big-ticket items, and with that, I will stop. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Christine Herman. I'm the Executive Director of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. And I will be very brief. I just wanted to add the task force's support to Senate Bill 928 and to just to recognize that the bill would cover domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking, particularly when speaking about sexual assault victims. We're often discussing a one-time event that completely changes a person's worldview. If a victim of sexual assault is able to continue employment, to feel safe at her place of employment, that can only assist in a greater sense of safety for the victim and a greater opportunity for the victim to be able to appropriately heal from the assault. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Bob Esterbrook, the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. You have written testimony from Bowley, so I will just say that the Bureau is supportive of Senate Bill 928. We would be proud to do the enforcement. It's consistent with, as has been mentioned earlier, the protected leave for survivors of these kinds of crimes, and we are hopeful that the committee will move this legislation forward. I'm happy to take any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the panel, Senator Boquist?
A few questions very quickly, Bowley. You listen to the earlier testimony. You're in concurrence. This is not paid leave?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, that is our understanding, yes.
Okay, follow-up question for the good doctor. In your testimony, and you don't have the answer, I already know, in paragraph 2, you outlined and you spoke about the number of
reported cases to you, so on and so forth. Justice is sitting right next to you there. Could you get back with me on how many of these cases were prosecuted or how many cases were prosecuted statewide in conjunction with the lady to your right so that we have an analysis of what you're getting reported and what we're prosecuting? The second question I have, which I know you don't have an answer to either, is in the last paragraph, you outlined the loss of productivity, so on and so forth. Could I get a copy of this analysis at a later point? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you all very much. Appreciate you being here today. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 928? Not seeing one. We'll close the public hearing on 928. What I'm going to do is, Mr. Baxter, I'm going to ask you to come forward. As you're coming forward, I'm going to go ahead and open up a first, I'm going to do a possible consideration and work session on Senate Bill 87. And my understanding at this point, we have all the paperwork back on Senate Bill 87 that will allow us to take a motion to move this to the floor. And this is Mr. Taylor's. And did you get any other information on that?
Just to remind the committee, you adopted the -5 amendment on this one.
Yeah. So everything's ready to go. We just need the motion at this point. And it does not have a fiscal that would require it to go to Ways and Means. At least that's my understanding.
No fiscal, right?
I believe the fiscal statement came back no fiscal. Is that correct, Courtney? Oh, it's a minimal fiscal.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 87A as adopted with the -5 to the floor with the two pass.
Senator Boquist moves the Senate Bill 87 as amended by the -5 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And I will carry this one unless Senator Boquist wants this one.
It's all yours, Mr. Chair.
All right. Chair will take that one then. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 87. And at this point, we're going to go in and do a work session on Senate Bill 570. And my understanding, the purpose of the work session today is only to adopt the -4s into the bill. We are still waiting for the fiscal impact. We have a no revenue impact statement. So the chair would take a motion to adopt the -4s in the 570. 570 is our metal theft bill.
Commissioner, we haven't adopted any amendments yet.
I don't believe.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the -4 into SB 570.
Senate Bill Quest moves the -4s into Senate Bill 570. Any discussion? Any objection? So order. And we're going to carry 570 over to Tuesday of next week. Hopefully the fiscals will be able to catch up with it. So that will be April 14th, 570 carried over till April 14th. And now we're going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 745.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 745 allows attorney fees for claims based on an express or implied contract, regardless of whether the prevailing party was party to the contract. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And Senator Bonamici, would you like to make some intros?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may see my name on this bill. It came to my attention when I was meeting with Justin and Michael Baxter, who have their office in my district, over the interim, and they represent Oregon consumers primarily, and there's been, as you know, a proliferation of identity theft in our state. And they were explaining a unique situation where our current law allows a prevailing party to recover attorney's fees if a claim is made on a contract of $5,500 or less, and even if the contract does not contain a clause that authorizes attorney's fees. Our current law also allows a prevailing party in a civil action relating to an express or implied contract to recover attorney's fees, even if they show that the contract is void or unenforceable. Our current law also allows, when a claim is made on a contract where the contract specifically provides that attorney's fees are allowed to one party, that the other party who prevails gets the attorney's fees. And our current law also allows attorney's fees on if a contract is assigned and there's a lawsuit on that. What our current law doesn't do, however, is allow for attorney's fees in a situation like the Baxters ran across, where they're representing somebody who's a victim of identity theft, and they're being sued on for a debt, but it's not their debt. And so they prevail in the case, and they're the prevailing party, but the attorney's fees provisions are set up so they apply to a contract, but the identity theft victim is not a party to the contract. So this limited bill is intended to address that particular situation, which I saw as an unfairness in the existing law and the way it was interpreted. And Mr. Baxter is here to explain.
Mr. Baxter. Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. As a prefatory matter, let me identify myself. My name is Justin Baxter. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. Let me, as a prefatory matter, apologize to the committee. My written testimony was inadvertently addressed to Senator Bottomici and her Consumer Protection Committee. It's my understanding that my office...
She had hoped that it would go to her. The good president gave it to me.
It's my understanding that my office has already transmitted the proper written testimony to your office.
Well,
Some of us don't care.
Yeah, some of us don't care. They would like the...
Yeah.
We're delighted to have you here.
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Boquist. I adopt and endorse everything that Senator Bonamici just said about the purpose of this legislation. I would like to just share with the committee a story about a particular client of mine, Mr. Frank Thomas. His story began from his perspective when he was sued by a company called MRC Receivables, ostensibly about a debt owed to Chase, a Manhattan bank, which he didn't recognize and never had opened, never had had a Chase account. But here he was being hailed into court, being sued for $10,000 or $15,000 debt. He hired my law firm, and we appeared. And the first thing we did was we contacted MRC's lawyers and said, this is not Mr. Thomas's account, and please drop your lawsuit. They refused. In fact, they engaged us in protracted litigation. We quickly determined, unfortunately, that all the evidence pointed to the account being opened by Mr. Thomas's mother, who had incurred some gambling debt and sadly had committed suicide shortly before being discovered. And so this is a case of adding, you know, painful insult to injury, where he had lost his mother, and then shortly thereafter he had been hailed into court and sued for a debt that she had incurred in his name. As I said, MRC would not give up. We practically begged them to drop their lawsuit, but they carried us through the ringer. The case was litigated heavily in court. We incurred substantial attorney's fees on our side, and ultimately we appeared at an arbitration hearing in the case that MRC and its attorneys didn't bother to appear for themselves. At all times, they fought us in the case, and ultimately we did prevail. At the end of it, we submitted a fee petition, an attorney's fee petition, to the arbitrator. And the arbitrator took a lot of time to write a well-thought-out award letter. As Senator Bonamici said, the problem he had was that under the court opinions interpreting the current statutes, the arbitrator felt that he couldn't award fees under those statutes because of two appellate court cases.
Mr. Baxter?
Yes.
We have your written testimony. Here's the situation. I've got two senators that need to leave here right at 10. And so if you want to make some closing remarks, I want to make sure you get what you need to on the record, but I also want to make sure we get the testimony and questions.
I will. Thank you, Chair Pozanski. Really briefly, in summation, the arbitrator specifically found that the company MRC had engaged in a strategy of pursuing a defendant because most defendants, most consumers, cannot afford to defend a meritless claim. And that's what we're seeking to change with this legislation. I'm happy to take any questions from the committee now or at a later time.
Thank you very much. Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Chair. And Council, you may not know the answer, but I'm curious, MRC Receivables, is that an Oregon-based entity, or is this another one of the piranhas from outside the state?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Boquist, MRC is a foreign corporation. Right. However, they typically come into Oregon by hiring local attorneys to bring their lawsuits for them.
I think the answer is piranha.
Correct, Mr. Chair. That's the correct answer, too. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Mr. Baxter, thank you very much for your time and being succinct.
Thank you very much.
All right. Anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 745? Not seeing anyone raising hands or running up here. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 745. And colleagues, two things. First of all, I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 389. The purpose to open up the work session is to carry that bill over until Monday, which will be April 13th. So we'll carry over Senate Bill 389. We're still waiting on paperwork on that bill as well. We'll close the public hearing there. And the last thing I want to let everyone know is that we're now getting into that crunch time. I'm not sure if we actually got the stuff reposted. And Courtney, if you can, if you remember, Tuesday, I believe we're going to start back and go to our regular time slot, meaning that we'll start at 8 o'clock. The chairs decided that it would be better to start at 8 o'clock and go to 10 instead of asking members to come back at 5 if we weren't able to complete. The goal of the chairs, we'll get in and out as quick as we can. We'll be making some fluctuations. The one thing that we will be doing, even though we may be listing at 8 o'clock, if the bill flow is not necessarily requiring us to be here at full 2 hours, we'll go ahead and just post for a later start time. But I need to give the public information 48 hours out. And so coming Tuesday, we'll just do a reminder on Monday. Thank you all very much. Have a safe and good weekend.
And what time on Monday?
Monday at 8:45.
Okay.
8:45 this Monday. And with that, we're adjourned until that time, April 13th.